What is it that keeps audiences rapt whenever Donald Trump speaks? Is it his years of television experience making him a genuine showman? Is it truly such a level of dissatisfaction with our failing nation that a man offering a way out is seen as a hero? Or could it be something else? Voting for that third option is investigative journalist and author Jeff Charlotte, whose article on the Trump phenomenon appeared in the New York Times Magazine under the headline, Donald Trump, American Preacher. And I am delighted that it brings Jeff Charlotte back to State of Belief Radio. Jeff, welcome back.
Hi, Wilton. Thanks for having me.
So I'd like for you to start by describing how much time you spent at Trump campaign events for this story.
I think last August I said to some magazine editors, I said, look, I think this is really going to go all the way. I think this is big. I think it's transformational. And we need to pay attention to it. And they're like, no, we're going to sign the story to funny writers. We're going to, we're going to do funny stuff. So here we are. And another editor said, would you go to a Trump rally? And this was so one Sunday. The next morning I had to get on a plane in 2 hours. So I had 2 hours notice and I hopped on a plane and flew to Youngstown, Ohio. And there began a sort of a month-long immersion in Trump land and rallies, mainly in Ohio and Arizona, but then reading through his books. And listeners might not know is there's also every Trump rally streamed online and then becomes part of this archive. And if you look at them, you see that tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, in some cases millions of people are watching these videos. It becomes like an entertainment. So when you go to a live rally, people stand around talking about, oh, did you see this rally here? Did you see this rally there? They're sort of like Grateful Dead fans who, want to tape every show. And so after sort of a month of that immersion, I came up for air and wrote this story.
Donald Trump, American Preacher. Now that's quite a headline. What did you observe that led to this kind of framing?
I didn't go in with a story in mind, but I did go in with a deep dissatisfaction, to be honest, with how my colleagues in the press were covering Trump, which is mainly through, even now, through either snark or this kind of very high-minded earnestness. Now, the snark is easy to dismiss. We know that that's not going to help us understand what's going on with something. It might help us laugh at it, and that might be healthy, but it's not going to help us understand. And the high-minded earnestness would be about the violence at the rallies. This is terrible. Well, it is terrible. But then the conclusions they drew that this is just anger. These people are just angry. They're just like George Wallace. And I'm like, well, first of all, it's not like George Wallace. George Wallace was a guy who part of his pitch was that, he was the son of a working man. Donald Trump's pitch is you don't vote for him despite the fact he's a billionaire. You vote for him because he's a billionaire. But more to the point, I thought, hey, where is this violence? And if you've reported the kinds of things that I've reported, violence is this heightened emotion, and it oftentimes goes hand in hand with ecstasy. It's also the performance of violence. When you watch the rallies online, Donald Trump, everyone gets very excited when someone's going to be expelled. So this seemed ritualistic. He coined a catchphrase, get him out of here. It seemed ritualistic, and it seemed the heightened emotion of violence was just a prelude to the kind of ecstasy. And so I thought there was going to be sort of a pseudo-religious element there. And at the first rally I attended, it was not subtle. It was overwhelming. And I was lucky because I didn't go as a member of the press. Donald Trump puts the press in a cage in the back and uses them as a prop in this sort of passion play in which he points to them and then everyone has to turn around and scream at them and mock them and flip them the bird and so on. And it means the press doesn't really have any sense of what's going on in the crowd. So I went as a member of the crowd, stood in line for 6 hours and got in and, swayed with them to the songs and moved along with the ritual with them, not saying things they didn't believe, but just sort of participating with them. And it became clear that for them, this was not about reason. It was about a kind of religion. But I don't mean that in the disparaging way that I think some liberals do. I think it's absolutely dangerous, but I don't mean it in that disparaging way.
Jeff, describe the audiences that you came into contact with.
Yeah, that was my first clue that this wasn't what people were saying what it was. I knew this was a caricature, but there's this caricature of the sort of the angry white men, these guys, these sort of like Duck Dynasty fans, screaming and sputtering with rage. So I was stuck in line with a group of college students. Guy had been a Democrat all his life, two-time Obama voter, and now changes registration in Pennsylvania, which takes some work, to become a Trump voter. And then a sort of a nice older middle-aged couple nearing retirement. Husband didn't talk a whole lot. The wife you would characterize as kind of a new agey, very pleasant. They were from Arizona. You might think she was from Sedona, that sort of new age capital. These were just not Trump voters. But then they would describe with relish the violence that they wanted to carry out on a protester. And it was sort of the joy of punching in their imagination. And this nice older woman would sort of tug me down and whisper in my ear incredibly lewd, crude things about Hillary whom she despised, and she had permission to say now. And I thought, this is something interesting. Now, the other thing that's important, I think, for people to reckon with, at least in Ohio, I met more Democrats than I met Republicans. And I think that's something that if we're thinking about the general election and worried about this from a progressive point of view, when I reported this, a lot of Democrats said, oh, that's not true. They're just pretending. I'm like, no, they weren't pretending. There's a lot of Democrats. There's a lot of people who would be Bernie voters if they thought he could win. I met people who thought that Trump was racist and didn't like that, but they were still going to vote for him, because he's the only one talking about trade, and he's doing it with this promise of renewal.
A lot of Trump coverage focuses on angry crowds and an angry candidate. In your article, you describe something very different from that. Talk about that, if you would.
People at a Trump rally are having a good time. They know what he's going to say. They've watched it online. They're waiting for the lines. It's like waiting for the lyrics, you know, of your favorite song at a concert. The nature of it is that you go and you wait for about 5 hours, and you're packed in there, and there's the Trump playlist. He's got this sort of playlist of his favorite songs, sort of a surprising playlist, heavy on Elton John, Billy Joel, Rolling Stones, and Pavarotti. And people dance they sway to Elton John, and they bop up and down to Billy Joel, and they're a little confused by Pavarotti, but they think it's very special. They think it's kind of grand and classy, like Trump himself. And they tell each other tales of his wealth. They talk about the gold on his plane. They feel very, very happy. You wouldn't describe anger as a dominant emotion. You describe joy. I think there's an anger that is feeding into that joy. Those things are not so separate. But the happiness is something that is startling. And I don't mean to say that people shouldn't be worrying, oh, they're happy, that's okay. Because what Trump is doing is different than anyone else in American politics. This isn't politics who invoked violence before. And certainly there's a strain of redemption through violence, but there's never before been a politician who would go so close to the idea that you find your true self through the dream of violence, that violence is this liberation.
Jeff, you seem to be saying that policy matters are irrelevant in Trump's campaign. It's how he makes his audiences feel. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And again, that's the kind of thing that I think sort of liberals kind of want to dismiss. Well, that's not very serious. Well, most politics is about how you make people feel. Certainly, I voted for Obama, but go back to 2008. How many of you can sort of remember specific policy proposals? How many can remember the phrase hope and change? How many can remember the feeling of hope that they felt that Obama was able to channel, right? So what Trump does that's different is he doesn't really deal in hope. And when you think about it, hope is a constant in modern American politics. It's not just the politicians you like, it's also the politicians you don't like. They're doing hope, too. Ted Cruz is doing hope. George W. Bush is doing hope. Their hope might be for something different, but it's hope. Trump begins as this rally by employing the whole range of human emotion. It's not just this sort of emotions in a box. So short on policy, but long on emotional complexity, if not depth, right? The fact that, like a Quentin Tarantino movie, he's really going to explore envy. He's going to explore the idea of vengeance, long set pieces and describing what will be done to America's enemies. That is a tapping into this sort of emotional feeling. I talked to plenty of people who, in as much as he does have policies, and he does have more than I think the mainstream press is giving him credit for. They're more and more disturbing. But many people disagreed with those policies. It didn't matter. It was about emotional power. It was about emotional affect. It was about a politician who gave them license to feel everything that they feel, not just hope. Donald Trump says this is not a politics of hope, but also envy, anger, the grotesque, everything in us that makes us human, for better and oftentimes worse.
If Trump is a modern-day televangelist, what will it take for a dose of reality to penetrate with his supporters?
I would disagree with the question. What's the dose of reality? Look, I come from this from the perspective of, for all the anxiety about Trump, I don't think we're taking him nearly seriously enough. And I've reported on, you and I have talked about all the different corners of the right over the years, Weldon. This is bigger, more powerful, and has gotten further and wants to do more, this movement. It's dangerous, dangerous, dangerous. But I think when we put it in those arguments of the dose of reality, what's the dose of reality? I mean, I think about big part of his power, and I talk about him as a prosperity gospel preacher, using the sort of the promise of health and wealth, the law of faith, not the hope of reward, but the certainty. You put your faith in Donald Trump or God, Trump will take Trump, you will be rewarded. As he said, it's not 95%, it's 100%. That's not reality, right? But what is reality is what he's talking about, that the mainstream Democratic Party, certainly the Republican Party, but also the mainstream Democratic Party dropped. He talks, the biggest part of every talk is about trade. The biggest part of every talk is about attacking NAFTA, attacking the Trans-Pacific deal, talking about specific companies, the number of employees they fired as or let go as they moved abroad. That is a reality that he is speaking to, that certainly the Republican Party isn't speaking to, Bernie Sanders is speaking to, maybe Hillary Clinton is now too, but there's no way you can say that the Democratic Party historically has. He's also speaking to a reality of racial conflict. He's speaking to it from the side of, let's stir it up, let's make it worse. But he's not crazy in saying, if you believe in a world like this, and a lot of his supporters do, if you believe in, so this, he's not going to call white supremacy, but that's what it is, then you're in a conflict. He's not going to tell you we all think the same. He's not going to tell you that essentially, you know, he shares the ambitions of Black Lives Matter, because he knows you don't, as one of his followers, and he doesn't. That is the dose of very frightening reality that they already have. I think, to be honest, I think it's the rest of us who need to come to terms with the reality of Trumpism and start engaging with it, instead of this insisting that this is a small movement of disenfranchised or angry white men. It's a big movement. It may not win. And if it doesn't win, I'm afraid people are going to say, whew, well, no need to worry about that. No need to worry about the discovery that some 30% of America is ready to embrace fascism and is ready to act on it.
Okay, so I'm going to depend on your wisdom here. What happens in a contested election?
I'm very frightened of that. I think we all should be. I think you talk at Trump rallies, lots of people in Arizona. Arizona's an open carry state, so there would be guys walking around with, Glocks strapped to their thighs. And sort of dressed up in sort of their own homemade SWAT military costumes and so on. They were pretty open, a lot of these guys, about if they felt the nomination was stolen, they're going to do just what Trump said they were going to do. They're going to be in the streets. And I think if it is successfully stolen, and it would be stealing, consider like this, you take all the sort of the militia types and so on and all their paranoid fantasies of government overreach, right? And look at the damage they can do based on these paranoid fantasies. Now comes this. If this nomination is taken away from them, it won't be a paranoid fantasy. It will be a fact. He will be the if they manage to give it to a Paul Ryan or John Kasich over the guy who ran and got the votes, they're not going to be paranoid. They are going to rightfully say this is a rigged system. And I think I fear that we would face a real serious uptick in domestic terrorism. So, but what's the alternative? Okay, well, we don't want that, so we better give it to Trump. Well, with Trump, we pay something even worse. I don't think anyone is taking seriously how much Trump would not be bound by the rule of law if he were to win. People say, well, there's only so much the president can do. There's only so much the president can do if the president gives a damn about following the law. There's quite a bit they can do. So I don't think we have a real good solution. And I think the other thing for liberals to be thinking about and progressives to be thinking about is I see a lot of support in progressive circles for the idea of the Republican Party coming to its senses and somehow wrangling the nomination from Trump. And I understand how tempting that sensation is. But you know what? I do not think that the response to the most dangerous kind of authoritarian movement in recent U.S. history is to just throw democracy out the window. You set that precedent, that's going to, you know, those chickens are going to come home to roost. That is going to be a huge step away from whatever democracy we have. So I think it's big trouble to the left of us, big trouble to the right of us, big trouble straight ahead. I think there's no way to avoid this storm, and we'll have to see what's on the other side.
Jeff Charlotte is an investigative journalist and the author of several best-selling books with a focus on exposing the true driving forces behind the culture and politics. His latest book is Radiant Truths, Essential Dispatches, Reports, Confessions, and Other Essays on American Belief. Jeff is Associate Professor of Creative Writing at Dartmouth College. His insightful article, Donald Trump, American Preacher, appeared in the New York Times Magazine, and we'll link to that from stateofbelief.com. Jeff, as always, thank you for what you teach us, and thank you for being with us again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Will. Thank you for what you do. It's a real great pleasure to be with you again. Thanks.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want you to know how sincerely I thank you. Your gifts are what keep this program on the air in large part. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person or those people. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes and in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. We would like for more people to pull up a chair and join this conversation. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long, online. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the conversation. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.